Welcome to the Job Shop Show, where we talk with the owners, suppliers, partners, and customers of custom manufacturers. Listen and learn the secrets of top-performing job shops, the tools, techniques, and backgrounds that have made them successful, all in the quest of raising the bar for custom manufacturing. I'm your host, Jay Jacobs. This episode is sponsored by Paperless Parts, connecting buyers and suppliers of custom manufactured parts. The Paperless platform is a secure, ITAR-compliant, cloud-based manufacturing system for suppliers that reduces the amount of time spent on sales, estimating, quoting, administration, and order processing. It offers seamless integration with the accounting and ERP software tools that shops already use, such as QuickBooks, E2, and JobBoss. Paperless Parts was founded with a mission to make manufacturing more accessible by streamlining the quote-to-cash process. Spend less time quoting and more time selling. Shazam! This is Jay Jacobs. Welcome to the Job Shop Show. This was a fun one today with Scott Hattrick and Mark Starnett joining us. Mark and Scott, along with their partner Sean, are owners of DMI, or Dynamic Metal Industries. DMI is a relatively new company, starting in 2019. Being digital natives and not having legacy equipment and systems has let them jump feet first into technology as a pillar of shop growth. We get into my favorite, pricing, and how and why they have embraced expedites, plus how technology helps them recruit team members, what they looked for in selecting an ERP system, getting a cobot running on the shop floor, and tons more. Whether you're a small shop looking for suggestions to grow or an established larger shop trying to freshen up, this episode will have something for you. And before we start, it has been clearly established that the smartest listeners subscribe to the Job Shop Show. So please subscribe today. It's an easy IQ jump and it would make my day. All right, let's dive in.
Mark and Scott, welcome to the Job Shop Show.
Thanks for having us, Jay.
Thanks, Jay.
So I don't usually have two people on at the same time, and we'll try not to talk over each other. However, Mark and Scott, and there's another fellow at your shop, if you could introduce him, are co-owners of Dynamic Metal Innovations. And do you go more by that or DMI?
We generally seem to go by DMI. Rolls off the tongue a little easier.
Yeah. So let's give the listeners a little context. Maybe you could take some time to tell us a little bit about your shop and a little bit about yourselves and your other partner.
Yeah, absolutely. It's myself, Scott, and my partners, Mark and Sean. And we're a small sheet metal manufacturer right outside Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. There's 17 of us now. We're in a 18,000 square foot facility that we outgrew about 2 years ago. So we've been quickly or slowly, whichever way you want to look at it, trying to find a new home to move into. We do laser cutting, bending, TIG welding, MIG welding, laser welding, robotic laser welding too, hardware insertion, powder coating, kind of the full soup to nuts job, you know, sheet metal job shop type work. We cover a lot of industries from the utility industry, telecom. We do some aerospace work, some defense work. We are ITAR registered. We kind of do a little bit of everything to help other shops and customers alike.
Thank you. Mark, anything you want to add and maybe a little bit about yourself?
But yeah, sure. Scott and I met in college. We went to Penn State. That's where we first met. And we kept in touch after we went to college and linked back up to, you know, form DMI. And Sean joined us. He was our first employee that started with DMI. And, you know, he's grown into being a partner. So now it's the three of us currently right now.
Did you guys study engineering at Penn State?
Yes, I was mechanical and Scott was electrical.
Oh, electrical. Those were the worst courses. I'm a mechanical engineer.
I agree,
Jay. I couldn't get out of those fast enough.
I agree with you there.
I have, at a hobby level, some car restoration experience. And my favorite part of restoring a car was always the wiring, running wires and programming the ECUs and, you know, just wiring up a fuel injection engine from scratch. And it's very satisfying to, you know, lay out wires and zip ties and the whole thing.
There's not a lot of electrical engineers who have a practical hands-on hobby like that.
That's true too. I've also wired up all the equipment in our shop, and you know, all the three-phase feeders to the laser and brake and transformers. And I think more of that is giving credit to my dad, who was big on electrical, and he was an electrician, and I kind of just absorbed a lot from him over the years. So school helped with the theory though. So, but I think I owe my dad a lot of credit for the hands-on.
We're going to get into the history of how you guys started, which wasn't that long ago. It was 2019, and you've grown pretty steadily. What I want to spend a good chunk of time on, though, is what fascinates me is two relatively younger guys. You said, we want to start a sheet metal shop. And because you didn't come from a shop background, I think it's given you some freedom to approach it differently than people who have been since day one in the industry and might want to go out and start a shop, or even the larger shops who have the people in their shop. Everybody's sort of risen within the ranks, and that freedom of not coming up through the shop. Well, let's talk about that. What are there some specific examples you can give me where you think you might be doing things differently than other shops?
Yeah, I think, you know, having a little bit of that fresher perspective definitely helps. You know, Mark and myself are 36, 37, and we have found, just from talking to other vendors and customers, that we are a bit of an anomaly in the industry. With, I still like to consider myself young at 36, and, you know, it is an aging industry. Not a lot of technology being used, you know, lots of spreadsheets for quoting and papers and just some archaic ways of doing things. And, you know, I guess coming from the engineering background and then, you know, just trying to leverage the tech that's available to everybody these days between some of the really great, you know, quoting softwares and ERP systems and just tech within, you know, offline programming. That was one of the biggest things that I said we have to do here. You know, even from day one, I wasn't going to use an Excel spreadsheet to quote jobs. I want an actual software that, you know, could read the DXF files or step files. As soon as we got a break that could accept, you know, some sort of offline programming, we jumped into that. Our, you know, I think it was our second year in business to just be able to accurately bend parts, because, you know, we started with a little Bailey 35 ton break, and you'd have a part with six or seven bends, and you get to bend six and there's one more left, and you're like, crap, I can't bend this part. And like, there's got to be a better way to do this. There's no way this is how everybody does this, you know. So that's when I just started investigating. And, you know, I kind of just take the approach of, no matter what you're doing, there's a better way to do it out there somewhere. So, you know, even now, you know, I'm still continuously looking at ways to improve and make things efficient and just better processes. And, you know, I think automation can, you know, it's kind of a four-letter word sometimes, but trying to automate, you know, as much as you can in the shop. It makes it better for the shop. The employees like it more. They like using tech. They like being on the, you know, somewhat on the cutting edge. It makes a big difference, I think.
What's the average age of your workforce? Do you think that the technology focus, where I'm going, is that helping you attract younger talent?
I do, yeah. I think our average age is right around 33, 34. You know, we have one of our welders, I think she's 22 now. I think our oldest employee is 45. So yeah, we're definitely a younger workforce that embraces the tech. You know, we have tablets on the floor, computers at every station for our ERP system. You know, we still use paper. I think paper is still important. You know, job travelers and prints, but just being able to use that software and just have, you know, computerized equipment and 3D controls on the press brake. And yeah, I think it's better all around, and it does attract more talent too. We're in a very old building, 100-year-old building. So I kind of joke that we're kind of that hole in the wall bar, but they make the best mixed drinks, you know, and people come to our shop and they're kind of like caught off guard by all the modern equipment inside. And I've had people literally say, you know, no disrespect, but you wouldn't know all this great stuff is inside this old building. And I said, I know. I said, It's just, yeah, it's a little bit.
Yeah, and Jay, I think that helps us build the culture that we want, you know, being a young company, having an employee workforce, you know, where the average age is low 30s. I think it helps us build that culture, you know, quicker. Any new company is going to have a culture, but I think, like you said, with the technology, the younger workforce, you know, gravitates towards that technology. And I think it's a benefit helping us, you know, evolve here.
Culture. You brought up the C word.
It is a C word.
Tell me, well, tell me ways that you are deliberate about creating culture, and tell me, maybe start out with, what is your culture? Describe it, or describe how someone working at DMI would say your culture is.
I think that's a really good question, because it's literally evolving as we speak. It hasn't stopped evolving. And I think we're still at that point now where we're trying to fully define that culture. If I could try to sum it up the best I could, I would say it's laid back yet incredibly fast paced. So the employees know that, you know, we're all here to have a good time, but we're also all here to work really hard. And they're all very good at striking that balance, because I think, you know, we try to strike that balance, you know, Mark, myself, and Sean. You know, we embrace the employees, we embrace their personal lives, we understand that they have personal lives.
You know, what Mark, does that myself mean? Have the companies idea, companies say that, and they, but how do you apply it?
I think, honestly, for me, that didn't, you know, as a business, small business owner, you know, those first, you know, 5 years, everything's a business all the time, no matter what. Because when you're starting a business, you sometimes don't have a choice. And I think it took for my son being born, he's 2 and a half now, to kind of like be able to step back and say there's a lot more to life than the business, even though the business is everything for us, because it's the most important aspect of my life, you know, professionally. And obviously you have to make a living for your family, but just understanding that there is a lot more out there, and it helps put things into perspective, and, you know, respect the fact that, you know, your employees do have lives, and, you know, we've never mandated overtime. We have employees that want to willingly work it to get things done, get things out the door. You know, we have monthly profit goals that the employees share in financially if we hit those goals. So there's some motivation there, but just that, you know, hey, you got stuff going on in your life, you know, we get it. Everybody has a tough life one way or another.
We do have a family atmosphere, and we try to embrace that. You know, I have twins that are going to be 3 soon, so I know what that family life is like, and some of our employees here. And, you know, I think we say we don't claim to know everything. We're a young company. You know, we do have a lot of different experiences in our background, so we don't claim to know everything, or we don't get everything right on the first try. But, you know, we try to convey to our workforce that we're going to do big things. We're going to go big places. That's the vision we have. We don't know totally what that looks like, but that's what we're striving to do within the industry.
And I think, Jay, you know, when the employees see the changes, massive changes over the past 5 years, and, you know, we're never sitting stagnant, we're always evolving, always moving. I think that's good for them to see too, that, you know, we're always trying to invest in new equipment when we can, you know, get into new processes. And when employees come to me and say, hey, this isn't working, I could really use this, you know, tool or this piece of equipment to make my job easier, it's usually a well-vetted recommendation, and it's an easy choice for me to say, yeah, let's do that, you know, let's get this. And so when they see that, you know, desire to grow and to make their lives easier, I think that's a big thing too, that helps all around.
You mentioned another C word, change, and they come to you, first of all. That's huge. What I saw with a lot of team members who joined Rapid was they had any initiative beaten out of them in previous jobs, and it took a lot to get them to accept change, because they thought if they failed, they were going to be punished. And that was not our culture at Rapid. It sounds like it's the same way with DMI, that you embrace change, you want change. And how Can you give me some examples of, maybe it's just you don't even think about it, but how does someone feel comfortable with change who's working at DMI?
I think for some, the change is difficult at times. I think it is something that you do have to embrace as an employee. Because I think, like, you know, like anyone, we like repetitiveness. We like a routine. And you don't always get that at DMI, especially with the nature of the work we're in. It's always, you know, high mix, low volume work a lot. And you're kind of always adapting to the jobs themselves. And that's stressful for some people, for sure. It definitely takes a certain type of person to want to embrace the stress that is job shop manufacturing. But those that do embrace that and do well with it, I think it fuels them. And, you know, that change being, you know, the C word, I think we try to use that to our advantage. You know, it's kind of like a running joke in the shop when a truck shows up, they don't know if it's another piece of equipment that's got bought or, you know, something different. And, you know, even when customers, we haven't dealt with a customer for a few months and they come into the shop for the first time in a while, they're always like, wow, you know, this wasn't here before, or this has moved now, and you changed this and you did that. And we're like, yeah, sometimes we just didn't get it right the first time and we screwed up and we need to move some stuff around. And other times we're just trying to make the flow better, or, you know, maximize the small amount of space we have. And, you know, and that's what drives me is, you know, my end of my role in the business is facilitating that change. And, you know, I'm the one that'll come in at midnight and work through the night to move a bunch of stuff around. So Monday morning, the guys come in and they're like, where did everything go? What did Scott do now? And there's a lot of it's just throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks sometimes. That's the reality of growing a company like this.
Yeah, I'll say it's definitely challenging for sure for our employees, but I think they get on board when they see the change actually happen and occur. You know, you have to plan and you have to go at it with a plan of attack. But if you're always talking change, but employees don't really see anything change, they kind of go, are we really changing, or are you just saying we're changing? And that's where sometimes, like I tell Sean and Scott, like, we have too much going in flux right now. We got to slow down. We got to make sure we're heading in the right path. But Sean and Scott are so good with making sure that we are changing and we are evolving. You know, sometimes you don't want to hinder that. You want to cut it loose and let it go, because that's when we're going to see results. That's when we're going to see employees getting on board.
How do you communicate change? Is that a formal process? You mentioned people come in and they see stuff rearranged, but do you also have that perhaps routine or structure rhythm of communication within the company, which would, I would assume, include change?
We all try to keep employees in the loop on, like, the big changes. Like right now we're working on moving the entire shop, trying to finalize a deal on a new building that's been in the works for a while. And, you know, we want to let the people know, because it, you know, it does affect some of their commutes, you know, and they're, again, that can affect their personal life, you know, major decisions for them. But then the smaller things too, it might just be like, you know, talking to the, like, example recently is talking to the welders that, you know, we need probably a thicker fixture table for some of the larger weldments we're doing. And yeah, let's start discussing that and, you know, seeing what makes sense. And do we wait for it until we move? Does it make sense to get it now? So just starting that, like, I'm usually kind of an open book with what's going on in my mind and some of the things I see and envision and want to change. And usually I'll be upfront and say, hey, this is a, you know, a thing in the future, but I'd like to get to here, or do this, and this. And, you know, for a while that was, you know, doing some robotic welding. And, you know, it took until going to FabTech last year to decide to pull the trigger and get a robot on our laser welder. And so, you know, I'll talk about things, but I'm always trying to figure out a way to make it happen. It's just, you know, in our industry, you know, cash is king, and you can't do much without it. And, you know, you have these grand ideas, but it all costs a boatload of money. And that's what makes it tough.
Yeah, one of my mentors, first mentors when I started Rapid, that's what he drilled into my head, Steve Cherry and Jay, cash is king. He goes, I don't care what the P&L looks like. If you don't have the money to fuel your growth, you're dead in the water. Cash, cash, and cash.
I guess that kind of leads to a question I had for you, Jay. Is I heard you mention on a previous episode that you would always make sure Rapid was around 20% EBITDA before you grew or broke a plateau. How did you manage that and enforce that, and what led you to get to that number to say, okay, we've got enough cash flow, let's spend and do this?
Sure. It sort of evolved, I guess, over the first few years that 20% was the EBITDA number that we were getting. And my observation was that if we were able to do that consistently for a few years, why shouldn't we always be able to do that? And why would I accept less than that? And over time, I realized that particularly from 2010 to 2017, we were growing 32% a year, and you needed that high of an EBITDA number to grow that fast. You think about it, 20% EBITDA, somebody might go, oh, wow, for every dollar, you're 20 cents. It's like, well, no, because I got to pay taxes on that. And then I already have, EBITDA, P&L doesn't include the principal payments for equipment and maybe a facility, depending on how you have that structured financially. Certainly you would like to take a little bit home. And then there's a much smaller than 20% number left to buy more equipment, expand your facilities, hire people in advance of them perhaps becoming really productive. That was one of the things we became opportunistic over time. We found someone who had a really great mindset and we wanted them in the company and figured out where to put them, but they weren't creating value yet. Cash is what enables that. And what I figured out is that, so I didn't have partners, you three partners make your decision, and I've got a question on that. But I demanded of my CFO and my COO that they were incentivized in bonuses. It was a combination of profitability and sales growth. So they couldn't just be profitable and not have us grow, and they couldn't grow and have us not hit that 20% number. They had to have a nice blend for them to be able to hit the bonuses that they wanted. And it was essentially unlimited. If they could have been growing at 100%, 30% EBITDA, they would have made gobs of money, a lot more than me. And that was fine.
Sure.
So incentivizing people, you have the profit number, which I think is good for your team. And kudos to you for opening your books like that. That was something I really wasn't brave enough to do back at the time. The way, though, that we sustain 20% is that I kept raising prices. And the way I was able to raise prices was the ability to constantly increase the number of RFQs coming in the door. And if you're at 20% EBITDA, you increase the number of RFQs and you have the same win rate, you should still be around your 20% EBITDA. If you want to have a little higher, then you reduce your win rate and try to expand your RFQs, and therefore we use pricing as a throttle, and you get the profitability you want. Sales and marketing, a lot of folks in the manufacturing business, they're more operations focused, and sales and marketing is more of a necessary evil. I'm essentially a marketing guy who sold because that is where the money is. And that was something that I enjoyed doing at Rapid and I had fun. So we were always selling, we were always marketing, and that enabled the RFQ growth, which then gave us the decision, do we want to add capacity or do we want to increase profitability or do we want to do a blend of each? And typically it was a blend.
Jay, I have a question for you. Did you ever get to a point where you're concerned about growing too quickly? You always hear those horror stories about growing too quickly. Was there any point
in the beginning, for sure. I always used to say it was a fine balance. It was like my foot on the accelerator. And if I pushed down too hard, meaning I had too much sales and marketing efforts, then I swamped the shop.
Yep.
But if my foot wasn't on the gas enough, just idling, then the number of new customers coming in and new opportunities slowed down too much. So it was really finesse. As you get larger, the systems get in place. You've probably seen that when you were 2, 3, 4 people. When a job comes in or somebody goes on vacation, you know, the impact of little things. And the larger you grow, and it's actually one of the reasons I wanted to grow, the larger you grow, the less of an impact of any one item.
And that's what employee or revenue level did you feel you felt you were in that spot where, you know, if a guy was out for a week, it didn't wreck a department? Or
I remember we had, I think, 3 press break operators early on. And so if somebody was on vacation and then somebody else got sick, your press break capacity went down to 33%. And that was brutal. I think maybe when we got up to 8 press break operators, I finally felt like I wasn't walking on the edge. But that's a fair number of press break operators.
That is.
I don't know what that equivalent was in revenue. I would say probably, guessing, maybe 5 million gives you more consistency. Certainly when we were at 100 team members, it was more like a machine, and it took a lot to change the direction in either way. However, that was something that I was comfortable with. And then you may have heard on the podcast, I think I've spoken of this before, what helped me sleep well at night, or once we started getting the profitability and we started getting the cash, I always had 1 month of revenue cash on hand in the bank. And then our receivables were roughly 35 days. So I always had roughly another month that money was coming in. So that, in a sense, gave me a 60-day window that I knew I could make changes within that time frame. That allowed me to go to sleep really well.
That's great. Yeah, the 1 month cash on hand is a good.
So I always think, I started my business 3 days after 9/11, and then we rode through the 2008, 2009 recession, and stuff just shuts off. And when you have the cash on hand, you're not making knee-jerk decisions to cut people or do whatever. You have a little more time to think about it.
That's great.
I want to get back, if I could, to technology, unless you have any parting thoughts on culture or communication or your team.
Oh, let's talk tech.
So number one, tablets on the floor. How do you use tablets on the floor?
We use a ERP system called Fulcrum, and we have tablets at every workstation. All of our welders have their own tablets kind of mounted to their, you know, welding carts. So that gives incredible visibility for everybody on the floor with the work that they need to get done. Fulcrum does an incredible job of their job trackers, very user-friendly. The team can pull up the step file right at their tablet. They can pull up the PDFs of the parts right on their tablet. They can clock into the jobs. If any jobs need a rework, they can order a rework, you know, back as far as it needs to go. So if, you know, if the press brake operator screwed up a bend and he knows, all right, I don't have any extras, I need more cut, he can go back and say, all right, we're going to have to deburr another one, we're going to have to laser cut another one, might need to reprogram this part. That can all be done right there at his tablet. NCRs can be created within there. Scrap parts can be scrapped.
How about access control? You don't want the welder being able to make changes, I wouldn't think. So what is access control built into Fulcrum? And
yeah, Fulcrum does a good job, you know, restricting access and only giving certain positions access to change certain things. So it's pretty well locked down and defined.
Yeah, we can, you know, we have a role in there called production operator, and we can say, you know, they can't see anything on the accounting tab or, you know, sales order tabs, or they can't adjust this or that. You can go, you know, as granular as you want with that.
And that's the, once you set the permissions with that role, then they're, well, that's it. until you make the changes. So
correct.
That's how it's going to live on the floor.
Yeah.
And I presume you could have a role for, you probably wouldn't, but every process, every station could have its own unique role if you really wanted to.
You could, yeah. If you set up like the work center as a user, you could have that be its own role. Yeah.
So tablets and Fulcrum runs as a web app. You also said you had computers at every station. Why computers at every station?
Well, we're kind of going back and forth a little bit between tablets and computers. It seems some stations like to have the use of a keyboard. So we're kind of looking at, all right, all touchscreen or keyboard and touchscreen. So we're playing a little bit with right now with what's kind of the best fit for us. Like at the laser, there's a full blown just desktop there with dual monitors. So he can bring up, some of the nesting information that comes from our nesting software, and then also look at Fulcrum at the same time. So different operations, get a little bit deeper into what they need out of the ERP, it seems. So we're kind of seeing what works best for us at the shop. One thing I can say from a tech end is hooking everything up hardwired is worlds better than Wi-Fi. We dealt with so many Wi-Fi issues, and
let's talk about that. Hardwire is what you're saying.
Yeah, the last thing you need is 12, 15 people on the floor that can't do their jobs right because they don't have good internet access. And I don't know if it's just our building or, all the metal equipment or metal in general, or, our mesh network isn't great, but man, we had so many connectivity issues, and it's hard to ask employees to use the systems when the technology is failing you because you just don't have internet. And that's when I said, you know what, screw it. We're a small company, so we don't have an IT guy. So it's me going up on the ladders and running LAN cables through the ceiling and, putting in the point of access controls and all that stuff. But once I did that, everybody was like, all right, this is great. Works the way it should. So that little bit of extra effort, is good. It's well worth it.
We probably should have saw this coming too, but we lost a couple laptops due to the frequencies that the welders put off. We fried a few laptops or two before we figured out that we might have to use something different or keep them further away from the welders.
That was
one of those things you don't know until you learn the hard way.
No, we have one of our welders has a wireless pedal on his 300 amp TIG, and every time you push the pedal down, the screen would go off on his Chromebook. And I was like, this is wild. So we got rid of Chromebooks in the welding department and put up just Lenovo tablets, and they've been fine. So it's just weird. Just some of that stuff you don't think about.
So new technology is a cobot, and I watched the video on your website of the laser welding. It seems like it's pretty new. Talk to me, you're a 17 person shop, and you've got I guess the correct term is cobot, but I'll call it a robot. Why are you making that investment?
Well, I think, me being sort of the, I don't know, techie is the right word, but just really liking technology. And we have a long running, blanket project for a customer that we've been doing for some time and is going to extend for some time. And, it's thousands of parts every quarter, decent size weldments out of 063 aluminum. And it kind of bogged down the weld shop. We have four full-time welders, and they're running through these high volume to us what are high volume parts, and other work was building up, and they didn't really care for the work either. It was tedious TIG welding. It took them a while. Fitting up was tough. So they were they weren't really complaining, but they're like, man, we'd like to do other stuff. They're incredibly talented welders, and their talents are wasted on just, chugging out parts. And we're already doing laser welding for a year and a half. The tough part about laser welding is, especially with wire feeding, is it can be tedious. The guns are kind of heavy. It's not as great with starting and stopping as TIG is. It can be tough. So knowing that, I couldn't just say, all right, we'll just laser weld all these by hand, because that would be a hard ask of somebody to do. And it would be difficult. So kind of stumbled upon this integration, with a Fanuc CRX cobot and the IPG handheld laser welders that a company out in California is doing. And you know, I think they have 30 of these out in the market now, and they're doing a lot of research and development and changing along the way. But we did some time studies, and you know, based on the time it takes to TIG versus the time it takes to laser weld these enclosures, the cobot would pay itself off in less than 4 months, free up the weld shop, allow larger throughput into the weld shop because they're not tied up doing all this production work. So we just decided to, you know, kind of jump in. And, you know, I think it kind of lends itself to, you know, that saying that when you're a hammer, everything's a nail, and, you know, you get a cobot on a laser welder, you're like, what can we robotically laser weld now that we have this? And so you start like hunting out things to do, and it's not the answer to everything, you know, neither is laser welding itself, but I think it opens up a lot of opportunities, and it's creating massive consistency for the type of welding we do. And it turns what is a tedious process into something that's pretty enjoyable. You know, I took a photo when I was doing some of these parts of me holding a coffee cup as the robot's, you know, welding away. And it's like, what do I do with myself? You know? So it's cool.
I think the productivity gains are real and there. However, what excites me is what you said that the welders really didn't want to be welding these parts. And we all know how hard it is to hire additional welders, right? So
yes.
You essentially created much more welding capacity through the use of the cobot, and they're getting jobs that are more challenging for them, I would assume, and they are thus happier, and you don't have to go out and find more welders to hire. You want a cobot to pay for itself. You want it to produce good quality and all those other metrics. However, I think that biggest bang is with the demographic collapse and all the baby boomers retiring and less people in the workforce, there's less welders to be had. And you are figuring out a way to increase your welding capacity without hiring more welders. And that's a huge win.
Yeah, we've proven internally that it's 4 to 1. So every four widgets the cobot can weld, you know, one of our welders can only do one. So it's the throughput is when you have good fixtures, your robotic welding is only as good as your fixturing too. So you have to have good, efficient, tight fixturing. When you can do that, have good parts that fit up, it's a big game changer. But you know, that upstream, you need a really great press brake. You need a great press brake operator to bend parts well. You need a good laser to cut accurate parts. You know, you need the stuff upstream to get you good parts coming into welding for laser welding and robotic welding. So it takes a lot. But yeah, that, you know, that cobot setup costs as much as a, you know, kind of the yearly salary of a single welder, you know, human welder. And it did free up our welders to do some of the more custom fabricating we do, which is higher margin work, bigger profits to bring through the shop. So when you look at it that way, it really makes a big difference.
And these are the little things that aren't so little in terms of reshoring work or making sure new work doesn't go offshore. If you can put the cost efficiencies of a cobot into your shop, you give someone pause and say, do I really want to deal with supply chain issues, or would I rather work with this shop within my 25-mile radius and pay a little more, but know that in actuality, I'm paying less because of the hidden costs of supply chain.
Correct, yeah.
That's a great point.
Let me ask you something that I was excited to hear about was you guys are using dynamic pricing and expedites to charge your customers a higher price when they want parts faster, which was a bedrock of what we did at Rapid. Tell me about your journey there. Why did you decide to do that, and how's it worked out? Where's it successful, and where have you backed off maybe a little?
Mark, you want to touch on that?
Yeah, sure. So we use a quoting software called Paperless Parts. And that was one of the biggest features that drew us to Paperless Parts, was that the idea of, it sounds very simple. If companies want parts quicker, charge them a premium and get parts to them quicker and get paid. But what paperless parts does really well is it makes it really efficient to set the quote up to do that, because you can structure a quote any way you want in any software, but paperless parts makes it very quick and efficient to offer three or four different lead times and structure that across the board. So if you want parts in a normal lead time, 15 days, here's your price. If you want it 5 days quicker, you know, your price goes up. If you want it 3 days, we can do it, but it's going to be expensive. So just having that flexibility to get customers parts when they need it goes a long way. It's kind of like that Amazon mentality that people see a price and they see shipping options and they see, well, standard's a week, but I can get it prime in 2 days. Why not? I might not even need it in 2 days, but just the fact that I can cut down that lead time and transit time and get it in-house sooner. A lot of people, that's a big deal, especially this day and age with design cycles. We see engineers, they want the parts 3 days after they finish their design. And you can look at that and you can say, well, that's not really how this works. That's not feasible, but why not? If we have the capacity and we can work around our schedule to get a customer an engineer parts in 3 days versus 10 days, why not do that?
I think it empowers the customers, and it, in a weird way, it removes competitive quotes, because you're giving them multiple quotes in a sense in terms of the delivery options. And so they say, okay, well, I'll just pick one of these, and they don't wait for another quote to come back.
Well, and to that point, Jay, I think when we were, you know, a customer would say, hey, give us your best price and lead time. And that's such a loaded ask.
Yes.
Because
yes.
if we give a lead time, we're pushing it and we're like, man, we got to charge a little more. What's to stop the customer from thinking that's just how our prices always are? And, oh, they're expensive all the time. Well, no, that's not the case, but you want this thing as quick as we can get it to you. So here's that price. But what paperless lets us do is say, hey, this is the price we'll normally do this for. And it's a great price. But if you want it in this time, it's going to be this much more expensive. If you want it even faster, it's going to be crazy expensive. You know, pick where your value is. And I think it just gives customers something that they didn't even know they wanted until it's in front of their face. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's great. You know, we just got fully onboarded with paperless a few months ago, and our running 30 days of expedites is, I think, around $5,000 or $6,000 right now. You know, and that's not jump change. That's another like 2% EBITDA for, you know, across the year. And it's significant to the bottom line, and it, you know, it directly affects the bottom line.
Yeah, I'll share that roughly 5% of our revenue was expedite fees. It varied by month, of course, but roughly 5% of the revenues at Rapid were expedite fees. And there is some cost to that, so it's not all pure profit.
True. Yeah.
Certainly, though, enhanced our EBITDA number.
Yeah, it's definitely been a real game changer for us, and it saves us a lot of time and headache and stress of quoting, because, you know, even if customers don't ask for it, if we have the capacity and, you know, we can get it out, we throw expedite options out there, and if they don't bite, that's fine. But sometimes, you know, they bite, and it's great.
You mentioned if you had capacity, Mark. So throw out that, well, over time we set on a standard of 7 business days for a turnaround of a prototype sheet metal part. And we knew we could make it in 5, but we always gave them a ship date of 7 business days. And that gave us essentially 2 days of buffer always in our schedule that we could slip in expedites. So I see a lot of shops who they schedule to capacity rather than leaving holes in. And originally we started that because we had in the early days more returns than we should have. And those, if you're scheduled to capacity and you got to turn around a return, then you're just blowing up your schedule. So we learned, in a sense, you know, unfortunate circumstances, something that became really powerful was to have gaps in your schedule. And what I found was particularly in the prototype and in the high mix, low volume type world, the customer was almost always willing to take parts a few days early. So that was the worst case, is we shipped everything a couple of days early. And I'll tell you a couple more stories. So we deliberately, though, I would walk out in the shipping area and we would have parts ready to ship like in four days. And I'd say, nope, those are staying on the shelf another 3 days, because we didn't want the customer to know that they were going to get their parts early without an expedite fee. But then every once in a while, we would get something done in 3 or 4 days. I'd say, ship it now. And it was like a drug. They'd get hooked on the quick turn. And so they would end up paying for it down the road, because they really learned that for a few extra dollars, they could get their parts in those days. And like you said, the engineers, they want their parts. So there's all sorts of games you can play. And we actually, over time, we systematized that. We had sort of a random number generator, and we had X percent of parts that could ship early. And so they were coded that way and shipped.
Perfect.
So I love the fact that you guys are doing expedites. I think every shop should offer it for two reasons. One, what the customers really want, and the customers are why we're in business. But the other is, it really forces you to understand scheduling and capacity in your shop when you have expedites. And but all these unintended positive consequences by doing things quickly that permeate and allow you to be a better shop. The other thing is, when you're doing stuff fast, your quality has to be dead nuts, because you can't have the returns coming in. So you learn how to have quality parts made every time.
Yep, that's a big thing.
One of the things I read in the, you guys had a really nice article in the April Fabricator, and you talked a little bit about how you have an equity partner who has come into the business, and maybe you could talk a little bit about raising capital and why maybe you chose an equity partner over a bank or some other avenue, if that's comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. We kind of got into this relationship with this equity partner by accident. It's not something we were seeking out. You know, when we started DMI in 2019, 2 years prior to that, I started a company called Aluma Flowers. You know, we make metal flowers out of aluminum and powder coat them, and we're still doing that to this day. My wife manages that business. But starting Aluma Flowers and running that for 2 years and making some money gave a little bit of a track record for banks. So when it came time to getting our first laser, which was an import machine, you know, 1500 watt with an IPG source, that allowed a bank to say, yeah, we'll give you a loan for that. And then fast forward a year after that, we outgrew that first laser, and you know, it was time to get into a big boy machine, you know, one of the big five lasers, and wound up settling on Mitsubishi. And one thing that was great about Mitsubishi is they have their own financing arm. So we worked with them directly to finance that machine. And they took a unique approach. And, you know, I was talking directly to the guy that was making the decision if he was going to underwrite the loan or not. And they looked at where we were, you know, where we came from, where we're at now, and then also where we're going. And it was not a very black and white transaction. They saw our growth and potential. And, you know, in 2020, our second year, you know, this is September of 2020, COVID is still very much a thing, a lot of uncertainty in the world. We did not have good financials back then, but MITS took a chance on us. And, you know, we bought a $700,000 laser, and they financed it. And part of their logic was, well, it's worth more to us than a bank, because if you don't pay it, we come and take it, clean it up a bit, and resell it. And it worked out. And, you know, we did some other financing too, but our salesman from Mitsubishi actually put us in touch with a guy that owns a shop out in Pittsburgh. And he happened to be part of this newly founded growth fund that a couple guys in the industry that came together and either owned big job shops or run big OEM shops, and they want to invest in small manufacturers and help them grow. And they focus a lot on the utility end of the industry. So, you know, substation cabinets and enclosures and parts for utility companies. And yeah, have some conversations with them. They came out and saw the shop. They liked what we were doing, saw the new equipment we had and our kind of, you know, trajectory and path forward and desire to grow. And we kind of just decided that this was a good relationship to have. Not only, yeah, they inject some cash, which helps the company, but now we have some operational partners too that we talk to weekly, almost daily sometimes, for advice of, you know, anything from personnel or, hey, should we hire more people or should we get more equipment? And yeah, that's invaluable in and of itself, to just to have, you know, experienced people to bounce ideas off of.
I agree more. I've had three mentors, advisors who helped me in the beginning, and they had the experience gained from the School of Hard Knocks, and they helped me not make some of the mistakes that they had made along the way.
Like with this, you know, potential transaction of moving and buying a new building, and the, you know, cash flow analysis they're doing and forecasting. And, you know, Mark and Sean and myself were like, we are operators. I want to just keep growing the business and, you know, buying cool stuff and making cool stuff. And they're able to come to us with a clear vision and say, no, you can't do this because of this, or no, this is going to work great, let's do it. And so having that kind of checks and balances really helps too, where, you know, one of the partners is a professor at Duquesne University, and he knows numbers inside and out, and he's, you know, very transparent of like, no, this is a bad idea, we're not going to do that, and giving the reasons why, and we're like, oh yeah, that makes sense, all right, we'll wait. So it's been really great. Yeah,
we definitely wouldn't be where we're at today without their support and advice and willingness to be available, you know, when we have issues or concerns. We have someone to go to that we can trust, that they're not just throwing cash at us and say, do whatever you want, because that's not what we were looking for, you know, in the business. We wanted a partner that's going to help us learn and grow. And like you said, they've been through it, so they know what to do. They know what not to do. So they're a great voice of reason.
And I think too, Jay, as operators, you know, for the first few years in business, you know, I kind of just ignored the financials, ignored the books, and you know, you just kind of make sure there's something in the bank at the end of the month and your people are paid and, you know, your mortgage is paid, and that's good enough. And having a partner like this, we have, you know, we have weekly financial statements and we're held to a higher standard, and, you know, EBITDA targets and all kinds of just financial analysis and targets and stuff that we're like, man, this is really important, because it's showing the health of our company and stuff that you can no longer ignore, you know, at the small level we're at and growing. So that in and of itself has been, you know, a good discipline for guys like us, that, you know, you get caught up in the day-to-day and you ignore some of the big picture financial stuff, which can cause your company to fail if you don't pay attention to it.
Which financial software do you use?
Just QuickBooks Online. So that integrates with Fulcrum directly. So most of everything is done in Fulcrum. Paperless is integrated with Fulcrum. So, you know, the integrations are massive, because it automates a lot of the process, and, you know, from quote to order.
Is that when you're looking at new software, their willingness to integrate or having APIs, is that the factor when you're evaluating it?
Yeah, big time. Like right now we're looking at changing our payroll company to move to something that is more vertically integrated within itself. So we don't have all these separate systems for payroll, performance reviews, SOPs, procedures. You know, I want the employees to be able to bring up an app on their phone and be able to bring up some of our SOPs and bring up our policies and, you know, do their performance reviews. And I think that's really big too, just not only from our side, but from the employee side of, you know, we've done these just terribly boring paper reviews, and it's just takes a lot of time. And again, it comes back to what I said earlier, like, there just has to be a better way to do this. There's got to be somebody out there that's, you know, doing this all in one. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of stuff that I'm always.
Well, when you guys make a decision, love to have you post it so I can share it with the world. And
yeah, we're vetting.
This is how we all become better, learn from each other. Yeah.
Yeah, we're vetting out some companies right now, trying to figure out the best choice.
And then we're also looking at the shipping aspect on the tail end, because right now we don't have an integration to Fulcrum that integrates and lets us ship things easily and have that back and forth with their ERP to capture all the data. So that's going to be a critical purchase coming up here.
We were a UPS company, and I forget how this stuff integrated, but I remember it was super easy. And you know, we had workflow where we created the packing slips, and that even, I don't know if it triggered the invoice or not, or at least it sent it over to our customer service people. And yeah, all that stuff, it flowed and made it so much simpler.
Yeah, the flow is so important.
So you mentioned your partners. Something that I wanted to ask you, and we went a different direction, but there's three of you who are partners. So before you go to your equity partner or a bank or whoever, how do the three of you get on the same page? Do you have weekly meetings? Is it at a bar after work on Thursday nights? How do you guys work together?
Yeah, I mean, initially, you know, when I started DMI, I had left my job at the power company in 2017. DMI was started in 2019. We didn't have the cash or income to bring Mark on full time. You know, he came on board in 2022 full time, but he was always working behind the scenes, doing the sales and bringing the work in and doing the cold calling and emailing. And I was running the shop and with Sean. And, you know, for a while there, you know, Sean was our first hire. Even before DMI, he worked for me at Aluma Flowers. And I always like just kind of never looked at Sean as an employee, for better or for worse. He was always kind of bared the brunt of my stress and days. And I was able to kind of just open up to him. And, you know, if things weren't going great, you know, he was kind of my little personal therapist at times. So he was always a confidant and big support, you know, just from the day to day until Mark came on board. But all three of us have such a different skill set, which makes it work well. I think you never really want to get into business with somebody that's exactly like yourself, because then I think it causes problems. And Sean is just so great at operations, and he's a shipping genius with packaging and palletizing. And Mark's great at the customer communication and the sales and part of the, you know, flow and operations. And I'm good at the business development end of things. So we're always able to, you know, conversate, and Mark does a good job of bringing me back down to earth sometimes with all the things I want to change and do. And, you know, there's that book, The E-Myth, the entrepreneurial myth, that I read initially. And it does a great job of explaining that, you know, within every business owner, there's, you know, there's an entrepreneur, there's a manager, and there's a technician, and they're always fighting each other all the time. And they all want different things. So I think the three of us kind of encompass that, and it works out well. But we do get together, you know, just throughout the day. Sometimes we'll just call meetings, you know.
I've tried the weekly meetings since we started, Jay, and we've never got there. And I think that's okay. I mean, I like structure, but, you know, we all three, you know, we'll just walk in somebody's office and say, you know, we need to talk about this, or let's discuss this. So it's so fluid that I'd love to have a weekly meeting, but we just kind of, we trust each other. There's a lot of trust there. So big decisions, yeah, everybody's involved, but we all kind of go to town on what we think we need to improve for the week.
So it sounds like the three of you guys are communicating pretty regularly.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And we have bi-weekly meetings with our, like, Zoom calls with our equity partner too.
Yeah, our communication never stops. It'll be, you know, sometimes 10, 11 o'clock at night, and somebody gets an idea, and we might not all be up, but the idea gets thrown out there, and, you know, the next day we'll pick it up and see if it's worth investigating or not.
Yeah, my wife's always yelling at me because, you know, I'll be on my phone and she's like, leave Mark alone, let him sleep. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, for, again, like, to me, it's not a bad thing, but the brain never shuts off, and, you know, you're always thinking about it, and the minute you wake up to the minute you go to bed. And, you know, those first few years, it was a bad thing because it was all consuming, and, you know, there were some dark days back then, but now it's more of a, you know, you're just kind of always tinkering in your mind, and you're like, well, we could change this and do that. And it's the fun of it when it's why I left my high paying job at the power company to do this stuff.
Yeah. Well, my challenge to you guys is, as you grow now, it's time to get it out of your heads into a system that your team knows exactly what you guys are thinking And that was, for me, one of the significant events in the history of Rapid, is when we started using a formal operating structure to get started with the executive team. It was just the three of us, and then we realized we had to push it to everybody else. And then we found the more we pushed it to everyone else, the more cohesive we became as a company. So we used the Rockefeller Habits, which has become Scaling Up. And there's another one that's very popular, EOS, Traction. I would encourage you to take a look at those. And then for a shop of your size, a way to get started, I actually created something because I think it's so important for shops. I call it the shop operating system, which is, in a sense, EOS Lite or Scaling Up Lite. And if you go to shopoperatingsystem.com, you'll find some stuff and be happy to have another call with you guys and maybe coach you a little bit on that. Before we take off, is there anything we missed? Any questions you have for me or last thoughts?
You know, Jay, one thing that popped in my mind, because you said, you know, talking with your leadership and the when you started implementing some of those, starting that trajectory to having that system in place, you know, how did you know you were hiring the right people in the right roles that meshed well with your goals for the company, you know, that super high-paced environment, the churn, you know, what is realistically a stressful environment? You know, how did you know that it's not just enough to have an interview and say, oh, you're a nice guy, you got some good credentials here, let's give this a shot? What did you do to, like, either just vet employees out or just get the right people in the right places?
I got lucky, I'll say, and however you create your own luck. And I am not a manager. I hate managing. And I was fortunate enough in 2010 to have to change out my general manager and find a fellow named Tom Persh, who he was out in the Midwest. He was moving back to New Hampshire because one of his daughters was having their first child and they wanted to be close to their grandkids. He needed it, in his mind, a transition job, and he was super qualified. He'd run two different divisions of Teradyne with over 2,000 employees in each of them. So I think at the time, maybe we were a 35, 40 person shop. And later on, he would tell me, yeah, I thought I was going to be here for a year and I'd find something that was more appropriate to my skill set. Well, you know, he was there through the day when we sold the company. And to be able to find someone like that and have them buy into your vision, that just, for me, took the management off. I think your question, though, more is hiring, but at the same time, it was, I wanted him. I went after him, and essentially I gave him too much money. And he needed it. He had earned it. You know, that was his place in life at the time. But for us, it was pretty rich. It didn't matter. If we wanted to become the company I wanted us to become, we needed someone like that. And my biggest concern was, could he adapt to the smaller environment? And he did. And that's just something you don't know. So you have, with your board of advisors, your equity partners, the fund, you have probably a network to tap into for people in all sorts of roles. I hired a CFO in 2000, I think it was 11. And what I realized was the financials were getting a little beyond me. However, what was the most important thing was, is I needed access to capital to be able to continue growing. And I had developed a relationship with my first banker way back, you know, I think 6 years earlier. And so that was someone trusted that I was able to hire. So it really gets into whether it's your network of advisors or the network of you guys. You know, Scott, you knew Mark back from college. There was a trust there. So think about, you know, when's the best time to plant a tree? You know, 10 years ago, think about ways that you can get out into your area and meet people who you might want to hire in 5 years or 10 years, who would be the, you'll have the relationship, you'll know how they work. And if you don't have those, then you've developed the relationship with others who can point you to trusted people. I never was very good at the interview process. I made so many hires that I had to unhire. And the best ones, though, were from my trusted network, and where ideally I even had some personal history with them.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, the idea of looking at people that you might need 5 years from now is, it's a good way to look at it. Yeah.
And then having the ability to grow from within, there were so many people who started as a $10 or $12 an hour beginning estimator who rose into different roles and engineering roles, people in shipping who managed work centers or different aspects of the shop. You know, what I loved and it gave me so much pleasure was giving people the opportunity. And there are some people in your shop where you've probably seen they take it and they run with it. And there's others who are content to be told what to do, and they'll do a great job and you need them. However, promoting from within, you know, they understand your culture, they understand what you guys are about. And I think in many ways, it's got to be a piece, but as you grow, you also need to bring in the outside experience and different points of view, because you don't want to only have a view of your shop.
That's great, Jay.
Cool. Well, I am so excited to you guys. Hopefully you don't think yourself as old, but you are the future of American manufacturing. You guys are taking the opportunity that is present today, that we need more industrial capacity, and you are digital natives. You're applying technology, you're applying your hands-on experience, and yeah, I only see the future incredibly bright for all you guys. Congratulations for making the plunge. For we didn't get into the story how you made metal roses for your wife, Scott, and that how that started. They can read the article in Fabricator. But you guys are crushing it, and thanks for doing what you're doing. Any last thoughts, comments?
No, it's great to be able to, you know, turn a passion into something that you can do, and you know, the passion keeps you going and fuels the fire to do some pretty cool things. So we appreciate the recognition, Jay.
Yeah, appreciate it, Jay. We're excited to see what the future holds for the industry, and you know, where we can go as a company and team and grow and learn. And, you know, we never plan to stop learning. And I think that's half the battle.
Yeah. If anybody wants to reach out to you, what's the best way?
Maybe they can just email me directly at scott@dynamicmetalpa.com or mark@dynamicmetalpa.com. We are on, you know, social, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, all those, you know, we're out there. It's easy to find Excellent. People somehow these days.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, guys. And if you are listening, I always like to leave you with an action item or a thought on how you might implement some of the ideas that you heard from today's episode. What I'm thinking is, here you have a 17-person shop who has a cobot now that is doing the work of four welders. They took the jump, and I would ask you, maybe a cobot is not something you can financially afford right now. What other technology can you implement that would help you not have to hire someone else, at least right away? The shops who embrace technology, who are always looking to integrate the technology and make their teams better because of it, I think those are the ones that are just on the path to stardom. The future American manufacturing is bright, so let's get on it and embrace that technology. Till next time, keep those lasers cutting, those spindles turning, and have a super day.
Thanks for listening to the Job Shop Show podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to subscribe and review on Apple Podcasts. Not only do I read every single one, It also helps me understand what content matters most to you. Thanks again for listening to The Job Shop Show.